Okay, let's go forward to reflective films. And I would give you two that are, I think, interesting. Schindler's List and Godfather 1 and 2, which you may not think of them as reflective films. What does Schindler's List do when it comes out? It says we've had all these Holocaust films. We've had Shoah, and we've had Sorrow and the Pity, and we had Anne Frank, and we've had all these kind of films. What can I do now? What can I do now at this period of time that's different? And he said, well, I'm going to talk about, well, you know, there actually were some people who helped the Jews, so I'm going to make a film about that, which had not been made up until that time. And because he's a supporter of Israel, I'm going to make a film which says Israel has something to do with the Holocaust, you know. And so part of Schindler's List is to show how the survivors from the camps end up being the first people in Israel. And that's one of the aspects of Schindler's List. And that cannot be made in a way in the 50s. It cannot be made in the 60s. It has to be made later on because it reflects what people are now thinking at this particular time. It happens to be a very good film, happens to be very well made, but in terms, it's not so much guiding, it's not way ahead of where everybody's thinking, it's sort of reflecting what most people are thinking at this particular time. Why does the state of Israel exist? It's time to rethink that. And he's saying, well, let's go back and see where the first settlers came from. Godfather 1 and 2 pushes forward the ethnic gangster movie. You know, the first gangster movies were also ethnic. If you go back to see those first films, a lot of them are Irish gangsters. James Cagney plays an Irish gangster because in the 1930s, most of the gangsters were Irish. By the 70s, when Godfather is made, the mafia is taken over, so we have this film about the mafia, but it's also about Italian culture. And who wouldn't want Marlon Brando to be their godfather? I mean, you know, you could just trust this guy. He's the patriarchal ethnic character that you can trust him, you know, even though he's vicious and so forth. But it's ethnic as well as gangster. So they've taken the gangster film and they pushed it and combined it with ethnic history. And then he also ends up having some Cuban history in there where you see the gangsters meeting in Havana, dividing up. And Meyer Lansky gives him a little cake and he says, isn't it a beautiful cake? And it's Cuba. He says, this is for your family and this is for my family. I'm not sure that they actually had a cake to cut up, but that's exactly what they did, because every hotel in Havana was given to a different mafia family. So The Godfather takes the gangster movie and pushes it to some new areas that it had never. So you got the regular gangster stuff, so you got lots of gangster fighting back and forth. You got the Italian stuff, and then you got the political things. So it's a movement forward of the gangster film. But it doesn't necessarily guide the nation into any new thinking, but it's just a new reflection. Today we have blacks in films everywhere, often not playing blacks. You know, you have a judge who happens to be black and that's all. You have black characters wandering around in films just like some other secondary character, and you see this particularly in youth films where in the teenagers, the black character in the group, people hardly refer to him as being black or her as being black. It's just a given, which is probably more reflective of people in their 20s now than older people. And you have the buddy film. Interesting enough, the famous Mel Gibson, Danny Glover, I keep forgetting what it's called. They've had about five of them now. Top Gun, Die Hard, was not originally written for a black character. It was originally written, there were two white characters. And the casting agent, Marion Doherty, said, you know, I got this young black actor, he's really good, why don't we make him the second detective? And the producers and the directors thought about it and they said, why not? So because it's 20 years later, instead of saying, oh, he's got a hat on, or we can't have a taxi driver, they said, well, we can make the other detective black, and they changed a few of the lines, and it was a big hit, and since it was a big hit, they've made sequels, and all the other studios made copies. So you have lots of these characters that are black-white buddies. And what you find there is what you find in American society is blacks and whites are together on the job, but they don't necessarily socialize after work. And so in that way, the films really reflect what's going on in society. And somebody like Spike Lee is very unhappy about all these films. And his last one, Bamboozled, tries to deal with racism a little more seriously. And his next film, is something I'm really looking forward to seeing. He's writing a film about the Max Schmeling, Joe Louis fight. And it's going to be something about race and something about Nazism and something about America. But this new film, his scriptwriter is Bud Schoberg, who he just admires and adores. And Schoberg is a great fight fan. He's been going to fights since he was 13 years old because his father was the studio chief at Paramount. So his father was a millionaire way back when it really meant something, still means something. But in the 1920s and the 1930s, if you were a millionaire, you really were quite wealthy. And he used to take Schoberg to all the championship fights. Bud Schoberg has been to every championship fight since the teens. Or maybe the 20s, I'm not sure, but a long period. And he wrote, of course, On the Waterfront, which has a major fight character, and he wrote other fight films. So the combination of Spike Lee and Bud Schoberg, young Hollywood, old Hollywood, African-American, Jewish-American, could be interesting, Max Schmeling, Joe Louis. What are they going to say? What are they going to try and do? I'm really looking forward to that one. What else do we see today? Well, we see sex. We see a lot of sex in movies. We see nudity, but in fact, the sex in the movies is strange because, you know, for all the sexual coupling that goes on, there's no venereal disease to speak of, and there are no unwanted pregnancies. And so you wonder, what kind of, you know, what's going on here? You don't even, it's not even a serious look at sex, it's just exploitive sex, and it's very much reflecting what people are doing, and it's pretty thoughtless. So, although they say daring, it's not really very daring at all. It's just sort of repeating what's going on in society and not thinking about it very much. Religion. Hollywood never makes films about religion, if you think about it. In other words, yes, they may have a character who's religious, but you never have a film in which somebody doubts the existence of God or there's a real clash between religions. They just stay away from that. They feel it doesn't make money. No matter what you do, you're going to offend somebody, so let's make something else. So there's almost no serious filmmaking about a religious topic. Maybe Woody Allen is the only person who's ever really talks much about religion, but you know, he does it in his own Woody Allen way, and it's sort of acceptable because it's part of his comedy, but it's not, you know, it's a serious part of his films. There's a new film out now by Kostas Gavras called The Deputy, which deals with the Catholic Church's role in World War II, and it's very negative on the church. I haven't seen the film. It just came out. It's been released in Europe. Hollywood never have made that film, period, because they would have thought about it, and they said there's too many Catholics in America, and the church is going to come out against us. So that's a European film. There's a very interesting film now, which is a independent documentary about Hasidic gays. Yes, they are people who are Hasidic and want to stay in their communities, but they're also gay, and you see them talking to the rabbi, and the rabbi says, you're an abomination, you can't do that, and the guy said, but I want to, you know, and they struggle. It's an interesting film. It's a documentary, so it deals with five or six specific individuals and couples and how they deal with their lives and their rabbis. And again, that's a film that would never be made in Hollywood. Never. It's just an independent film. It's a documentary, and it's floating around New York now. It's doing tremendous business at the art theaters. But you don't get that kind of discussion from Hollywood. Politics. Hollywood never makes a serious political film. It really, I mean, I'm maybe overstating, but they really don't. And then I'm going to give you an example of when they did. Generally speaking, politics is taboo because no matter what you do, you offend somebody, you offend the government, and et cetera, et cetera. So they just don't want to touch politics. So unless it's a quirky guy who has a lot of money and just somehow gets it through, you don't get anything on politics. So let's look at JFK, Oliver Stone's JFK. And that tells you almost everything you need to know. Oliver Stone had a number of very successful films, so people knew that his films usually make money. He wanted to make a film with the JFK assassination, and he was able to get $40 million together to make the film, which is, at that time, was a moderate to large sum of money. What happened? Before the film was made, the film was attacked in Time, Newsweek, and all major media as a distortion of the truth. Before the film was made, somebody went into his office, stole the script, and they wrote a review based on the script explaining why this film was inaccurate. The film that was made was not even based on that script. So here you have a film, before it comes out, has already been denounced, when the guy who was making the film didn't even know exactly where he was going to go. So it really indicates very clearly that when you take a serious issue like who killed the President of the United States, and you want to go against the grain, when you want to go against the Warren Commission report, all of mass media will come out against you. And I guarantee that when you look in the newspapers, they'll say, oh, you're an Oliver Stoneite. Oliver Stone's conspiracy theories, it's become like a negative, dirty word that if you're like Oliver Stone, you must not have any brains. Well, if you look at that particular film, I think he's much closer to the truth than the Warren Commission report is. But a lot of that film, part of it is fantasy and part of it is fact. And he's written a book based on the film, which he presents all the evidence as to why he put this particular scene in, why he put that particular scene in. And practically everything you see in that film is factual. Now, how the facts fit together, you know, there are statistics and there are numbers. But there's in the scene you see where Lee Harvey Oswald's office is directly above the anti-Castro office. Well, that building exists. He didn't make that up. That's the exact building. He has a little flyer in there in which the pro-Castro leaflet has the address of the anti-Castro organization stamped on it. He didn't make that up. That's a real leaflet that they found. And if you go through the whole film, you'll find that every single factual detail has something behind it. Even the way people dress, even outlandish garb that you say, well, this is just Hollywood, turns out not to be Hollywood. It turns out to be based on photographs. So rather than looking at JFK and saying, does Oliver Stone have something really important to say here, it's generally dismissed and scoffed at, but the public liked it, and the film did make money and continues to do well in cassettes. But you're not going to get very many films like that which seriously take to task any policy of the American government. The closest thing you'll have is something like Three Kings, I don't know if some of you saw that, which kind of pulls at the Gulf War and suggests the Gulf War was about oil, but it's not a serious indictment. And I'll give you two more, and then I'll take some questions. Salt of the Earth is an interesting film that some of you may know about. When the Hollywood blacklist occurred, some of the people who had been blacklisted decided to make a film. They said, well, we're blacklisted, we may as well make the films they never let us make in Hollywood. So they made Salt of the Earth, which is about a strike in New Mexico by the United Mine Workers and Smelters Union. They were very radical. The film doesn't say so, but they were a communist union, and that was a communist local. But it's basically about Mexican strikers. And so there's a tension between the Mexicans and the Anglos. There's a class basis with the strikers versus the company. And then there's a wonderful thing about the women, where the women actually end up taking over the strike. And I would say they win it for the men, but they play a key role in the strike. And there's a very interesting tension between the strike leader, the Mexican strike leader, who's a very nice guy, very brave and so forth, but he doesn't want his wife out of the kitchen, you know. And when she comes out of the kitchen into the strike line, he gets very befuddled. So it's a very interesting film. It was written in conjunction with the people who actually did the strike, and it's got some Hollywood actors in it, and it's got a lot of people who actually took part in the strike, so that the main actor in the film is the actual guy who actually ran the strike, and his wife is a Mexican actress that they brought over to play his wife. And the sheriff and others are Hollywood actors that you will recognize as soon as you see them. Okay, they made the film. Well, it wasn't so easy to make the film, because as they were making the film, airplanes would fly over. All kinds of disturbances were made. People who were participating in the film were told they were going to lose their jobs and all this kind of business. When they shot the film, none of the labs would develop the film. So they had to they gave it to friendly technicians who would go at night, in the middle of the night, to do the film. The American government, the Mexican actress made a mistake and went back home to Mexico, and the American government wouldn't let her come back. They stopped her at the border, so the last scene had to be manufactured from outtakes. Despite all that, they made this movie, and then they thought they were going to be able to show it in the United States so people would see what a blacklisted film was like and what a strike was like. And they opened up in New York, and the American Legion and other organizations came out and picketed, and the very conservative projectionist union said, any theater that shows this film, the projectionist will no longer project any other film for them. So if you were a film person and owned a theater, if you showed this film, the guy who ran all the other films would no longer work for you, and since it was 100% organized, it means you would go out of business. So the film was not shown in the United States. The FFL-CIO made it, if a union local showed this film, they could be expelled. So that's what happens when you make a film that goes against the grain. I mean, in the sense of it's land of the free and there's free speech, but there are all these problems. The film was very successful in Europe. It actually made its money back in Europe, was heralded at various film festivals, and then disappeared, shown surreptitiously here and there. And then in the 60s, when a new radical movement arose, people said, what is this Salt of the Earth? And began pulling out things of it and showing it. And it slowly has regained its visibility. And now it's on the AFL-CIO recommended film list. So when you make a series, it really is. So if you want to make serious films about serious topics, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. Now, the last one I'll talk about is just one that I happen to like and everybody thinks I'm crazy. It's a film called The Freaks. And it was made in the early 30s. It was one of the first sound movies ever made. It was made by Todd Browning, who had done a series of other horror-type films. And he was a person who directed the first Dracula with Bela Lugosi. So this was his specialty. And Lon Chaney was his man. Almost all the good Lon Chaney films were directed by Todd Browning. Todd Browning loved circuses. He just loved the circuses. And he loved the sideshows. And he was friends with sideshow entertainers. So he decided to make a film in which the sideshow characters, who are, quote, freaks, would be the major characters, and they would be shown to be normal. And the people who came to see them would be abnormal, and they're freaky. So he has, I'm not sure what the correct term is now, but we used to call them mongoloids, with their heads kind of point up. There were three sisters like that. He had them in the film. He had Siamese twins in the film. He had a man with no arms and legs in the film. He had all manners of dwarfs and midgets. And the main storyline was that little Fritz, who's about 4'5", falls in love with Olga Baklanova, who is this 6'3", blonde, statuesque acrobat artist. And she laughs, and she's in love with the strong man, you know. And what happens is she laughs at him and makes fun of him until she finds out he's a millionaire. Then she decides to marry him and poison him. And so the story is all that happens, and you have many of these little scenes. Many of them played, it's almost like vaudeville, like the Siamese twins. Each have a boyfriend, and the boyfriends don't like each other, and they have these four-way conversations. They're corny, but they're also hilarious. And you see some of the men do their acts, like the man without the arms and legs lights a match and lights a cigarette. That was his act. You see him do that. It's very disturbing. I mean, you see people without arms eating with their legs. You know, they're sitting around talking. It's like it's coffee time, and so this woman without arms is sitting there and she's drinking her coffee with her leg. You know, and somebody else who's like has some other deformity is sitting there talking to her, and they're quite normal, except for their physical bodies. They're the only thing that's not normal. And what happens, of course, is everybody finds out finally that this acrobat giantress is poisoning Hans, and they decide to take revenge on her. And the end of the film is this terrible, horrible section, which, if you like film noir, it has all the aspects of film noir, which will come 15 years later, and the freaks do a revenge. And they do a horrible revenge on the woman, so that by the end of the film she can now really join them, because they turn her into, quote, a freak as well. Okay, they show this film and people went absolutely hysterical. First of all, they didn't want to see this. They didn't want to see, yeah, they wanted to see Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. They didn't want to see people with arms and legs. They didn't want to see midgets and so forth. And they didn't think it was such a good idea that a beautiful blonde acrobat, however bad she was, should be deformed by the revenge of the freaks. And so this film was pretty much killed. They put several new endings on it, as they often do when films don't work out, and nothing happened, and the film just ceased to be shown anywhere. It started being shown at carnivals sometimes, and in pornographic, people who did pornography also had this particular film, and it lay unknown or just discussed and legendary for many years. What I haven't talked about is violence, and I'm going to leave that for people who want to ask questions. So, thank you.